in this day and time when, believe it or not, our country is rather divided, when there are divisions that even work their way into our church, the question for me in ministry is how to have a cross-shaped people that is unified by the cross of Christ when everything around us pulls us toward division. And so my ministry in that sense really shapes the questions I'm asking of text. And then text is helping me understand how to deal in a ministry context. So thinking about the church in general and how we have as a people, and especially as a legalistic people of a legalistic heritage, how we have struggled to bring unity that we spoke of 200 years ago in the founding of our movement. We have been more people creating divisions. That the church should be a place where Christian unity is most visible. Yet sadly, the church over the years has simply reflected the divisions of our society. And I know that as neighborhoods have changed, as societies have changed, churches have not changed and adapted with their society or with their neighborhoods. And this is a cause for concern for church leaders who look at a church that does not reflect the diversity of the neighborhood around them. What is especially troubling from a church perspective is that the church growth movement has leaned into racial and ethnic divisions as a platform for church growth. You know the Donald McGavran, the late esteemed professor at Fuller, who summed this up well in saying, in most cases, the arrested growth of the church, in most cases of the arrested growth of the church, men are deterred not so much by the offense of the cross as by non-biblical offenses. Nothing in the Bible, for instance, requires that in becoming a Christian, a believer must cross linguistic, racial, and class barriers. So he's saying that having to be with people different from you is not a prerequisite of the gospel. Now, to his credit, he goes on to argue that such unities, transcending these barriers, should be a fruit of the Spirit. But he endorses racial and ethnic barriers as a tool for evangelism. And this, I think, leaves a dark mark upon the church today, and even upon the thinking of so-called megachurches that reach out to a particular niche of society, whether it's a generational niche, or an ethnic niche, or a political niche. And we know sad examples, like from Rwanda and others in our world today, where Rwanda was widely noted to be the most Christianized nation on the African continent, but you had Christian Hutus killing Christian Tutsis. And so, did the gospel just not have enough time to produce the fruit of unity? Or was the approach of the church fundamentally flawed and not cross-shaped enough? So I'm looking at Ephesians 2:11 through 22 as a template for understanding how the Christian faith should, from the very outset, insist upon us crossing the barriers of our society. And there's certainly plenty that I could talk about, and my paper certainly deals with some of those things, but let me skip to the text itself, to Ephesians 2:11 through 22. As this text comes to us, I would argue that the primary shape of this text is that it is a cross-shaped text. It is a cruciform text. The primary feature of this passage, from my perspective and from the questions I'm bringing to the text, are its focus on the cross and on Jesus' work on the cross. The only occurrence of the word cross in the book of Ephesians occurs here in verse 16, where, I guess I should have my Bible open to read it, where Paul writes that he might reconcile both groups to God in one body through the cross, thus putting to death that hostility through it. The work of Jesus, namely his death on the cross, lies at the heart of this section. And surrounding the mention of the cross are two key terms which both occur twice in a negative or positive sense. And those are the words flesh and spirit. In verse 11, Paul uses the word flesh twice. although the NRSV, for example, translates it by birth, it's in the flesh in the original text. In the flesh is a defining characteristic for non-Jews who are Gentile by birth or in the flesh. And Jews as well are Jews in the flesh. Their circumcision, which Paul argues is a human work, a statement which I think would be offensive to Jews who believe circumcision was a divine work. He's saying it's a human work. It is in the flesh. It is a fleshly difference. It's a fleshly division between people. And what Paul is arguing is that in the flesh, we have divisions of all kinds, and primarily his focus is on the Jewish-Gentile division. And he's saying that the fleshly divisions produces subsets of the human race who are either arrogant on the one hand about their privileged position, or who are, on the other hand, excluded from the promises of God. Now, what's ironic as Paul moves through this text is that the answer to the fleshly divisions also lies in the flesh. Verse 14, it's Jesus' flesh becomes the answer. The powers and principalities are out to destroy the flesh, and they're just doing their thing in destroying Jesus. Little do they know that in destroying Jesus' flesh, they are also destroying themselves. They are signing their own death warrant. And so Jesus' death on the cross, his flesh, in his flesh, the text says, is where both groups now come to be one. And the second word that's key in this text is a word that occurs twice after the cross, and that's the Spirit. For it's now in the Spirit that we are built into a dwelling place for God. Verse 18, we have access to the Father in one Spirit. Or verse 22, we are being built together, the NRSV says spiritually, but it's in the Spirit, into a dwelling place for God. So the work in the flesh, at least our work in the flesh, is a work of division, separation, barriers, hostility. But the work in the Spirit now is a work of unity, of coming together in peace, and of Jesus working in our midst and God being glorified. So I would say that Jesus' flesh is the place of peace where enmity goes to die and where a single humanity inside Christ is the result of the Spirit's work. So the cross is the central transformative piece in Ephesians 2:11 through 22, flanked on either side by two destructive uses of flesh and two reconstructive uses of spirit. These highlight life before and after entry into the people of faith. So what is crucial to realize for us as church leaders, as ministers, is that the cross is supposed to bridge the divisions of the flesh to the unity of the Spirit. We can't wait for the fruit of the Spirit to come some future time down the road. Instead, we must somehow drag our churches through the cross. Rather than, as McGavran says, the cross is not an offense, I would say the cross is a place of death. It is the death of human divisions. And so thinking practically in my last couple of minutes, as I've looked at my own church and the divisions in my church, the divisions politically speaking, divisions ethnically speaking, socioeconomically, age divisions, how in the world am I supposed to, as a minister, bridge all of these divisions? How do we bring people together? And of course, the answer is that I can't bridge those divisions, but I must insist that our church go through the cross of Jesus. And I look at one of the most powerful symbols that we have week in and week out in our churches, which is the Lord's Supper. A time of communion that we have turned into a ritual act of just simply passing trays, a transactional experience, which typically leaves us as individuals alone with God, but does not force us through the cross to bridge the barriers that exist in our own church buildings. A year ago, we removed communion servers. We instead of thinking about, can women serve communion? We just said, we're not going to have communion servers anymore. We're going to have four tables in our church building, and people are going to be invited to the Lord's table every Sunday. I'm hugging people who love Trump and who love Hillary. I'm hugging people who are old and young. I'm holding those who are black and white, Hispanic. I am able to hug people in the peace of Christ at the Lord's table because we are insisting that people must come through the cross of Christ. I don't know the long-term repercussions of this type of thing and others that we need to insist upon, but I do believe that as church leaders, it's my responsibility to drag the church through the cross of Christ, because the cross of Christ is indeed where divisions go to die and where unity in the Spirit is born. Thank you.
I'm going to ask you if you would to maybe reserve questions that you might have. And if Don doesn't get too lathered up here, we'll be fine for a few questions at the end. But our second presenter today is Don McLaughlin, who I think all of you know very well.
Thank you, ma'am. Get the timer.
Can you set it for me?
Got it.
Okay. Well, good morning. I'm glad that you're here. 19 years ago, I had the privilege of joining the North Atlanta Church of Christ in Atlanta, Georgia. I anticipated moving from Indiana to Atlanta, that there would be more integration. And to my surprise, that wasn't the case. Wonderful church, about 95% of the people wrapped in my color. And so the first question that I asked our shepherds, I changed. I had a set of questions because we were considering working together. So I changed the first question. The very first question I ever asked our elders were, are you primarily white on purpose, or do you not know how to reach out to people that aren't white? And they said, we don't know how to reach out to people that aren't white. And so we had, which was progressive at the time, we had a black elder and his wife, both African American. So I said, Donna, what is it like to be black at North Atlanta? And one of our white elders began to answer for her. True story. But there was great hope in what happened next. She looked at him and said, I'll take this one. He was quiet, and she spoke. A black woman had told a white man to be quiet, and he did. We read and hear a chorus of lament in America right now over the toxic nature of this private discourse and public discourse. We're having trouble talking about things that matter. And one of the reasons, I believe, for that is because we have not matured in our ability to discuss things that emotionally wrench us. So we have emoticons, and they just keep growing, right? And you can hammer away with emoticons, right? But one of the ones I would love to have is an emoticon that says, I want to listen to you, and I want to listen well. I think about a key example came in the aftermath of the death of Freddie Gray in Baltimore. Politicians and newscasters used the word thugs to describe those who were rioting and demonstrating against the systemic racism in the policing practices. To the average white person, the word seemed appropriate for the actions they were observing. But it was only after some African Americans began to discuss the word thug and how it had become a term of negative derision that whites, some, began to set up and take notice. Then a divide typical of our culture erupted. Some mocked their concern about the use of the word thug, blaming it on political correctness, while others appreciated and respected the conversation and thought it was helpful and constructive. I think what separates the two is empathy and humility. I have to ask the church over and over again, is dismissing the cries of others the best we have to offer? Coming directly on the heels of our growth and healthy conversations is in learning how to listen well and how to answer this question. Do I have to know you less to love you more? We often say, well, you shouldn't talk about politics or religion. The reason that we say that is because we are too immature to hear somebody's difference and still know how to love them. This question has had a terrific change in my life. One of our elders' wives, Donna, again, gave me an article written by Judge Clarence Thomas's wife. It was an article on being colorblind. I read the article, I came back to her, and she asked me, "What did you think?" I said, "I thought it was great." She said, "The article's terrible." I said, "Oh." And I said, "Well, what's terrible about it?" She said, "I want you to go back and learn how to read an article in such a way that you could realize what's terrible about it." So I went back and I read the article, and I found out that there is an extremely important implication to the word colorblind. It means if I notice your color, it will go badly. Inherent in the word colorblind is that if I notice your color, it will be a negative outcome. If it was a positive outcome, why would I want to be colorblind? When is the last time you walked through a rose garden and bemoaned that they're not all gray? God is a God of color. He loves color. Why would I not instead become colorful like Him? This built a movement that started in our church 18 years ago of the difference between assimilation and intentional integration. Put simply, did people who are not white have to act white in order to fit in? When I would ask our members of color about this, there was an initial hesitancy. Their simple hesitation was answer enough that we had a problem. But I wanted more, more understanding, more nuance, more insight. Several of them suggested books for me to read. Two of the books that I read side by side were Souls of Black Folk by author W.E.B. Du Bois, and also Up from Slavery by Booker T. Washington. As I read these two giants of the early 20th century, I came to an excerpt from Du Bois that could be beneficial for us today. He writes, "Between me and the other world, there is ever an unmasked question. How does it feel to be a problem? One feels his two-ness, an American, a Negro, two souls, two thoughts, two unreconciled strivings, two warring ideas in one dark body, whose dogged strength alone keeps it from being torn asunder." It was Du Bois who initially apparently coined the phrase double consciousness, that I'm always thinking about who I am and who I am when I'm with you. In a slightly comical aside, I wanted to illustrate the problem of assimilation versus integration, and a friend and I were discussing this and talking about W.E.B. Du Bois, in which he corrected me. He said, "It's pronounced Du Bois." Well, I produced a 1939 document where Du Bois himself, in the Chicago Sunday Evening Club, dated January 20th, 1939, explained that his name was pronounced Du Bois, to which my friend said, "Huh, he didn't even get his last name right." When applied to the church, it is inconsistent with the gospel of Jesus that anyone should have to endure systemic racism to find love, respect, and full fellowship in their church. One should not have to hide a part of themselves to experience the love, compassion, acceptance, joy, and sweet fellowship at the table of the Savior in the midst of His family. So let's move, as we move along, the paper has more to it. I want to come to our discussion of the Great Commission. The spirit and the mandate of diversity is cemented in the Great Commission, and even more clearly articulated in Acts 1:8. The commission of Christ is the discipling of all ethnos, all nations. The miracle of Pentecost is not the tongues of fire, but the tongues of nations. With breathtaking boldness, this gospel theme drives the early church. The commitment to all the widows in Acts 8. The baptism of Samaritans in Africa, or in Acts 6. The baptism of Samaritans and Africans in Acts 8. The baptism of a Gentile in Acts 10. The determination that there will be one church for all and no church for some. The elect will be one family of God through the blood of Christ, not the elite family of a race through the blood of man. Then, of course, there is the great command. The letters of Paul are stuffed with the practicality of reconciliation. The work of Jesus on the cross is not just a ticket to an eternal home on the blissful shore by and by. Jesus had done something at the cross that would change the way that people live right now. I would call that access to all, privilege to none. From the gospel perspective, everything that turns humans against each other or even away from each other is not of God and has no place in the church. In order to build a fellowship that bears witness to the unifying work of Jesus Christ in the world, we had to figure out how to have substantive conversations about difficult issues. We hosted a learning seminar for all of the leadership of North Atlanta to teach us how to listen. I took two men, I put them at the front of the group that morning, and we had the group split them in half, and I had them make, with 3x5 cards, I had each person on one side of the room write something that would end a conversation. I can't believe you think that. That's so stupid. Dumbest thing I've ever heard. Who believes something like that? On the right side, I had them write things that keep conversations going. Tell me more. I want to hear more about that. We may disagree, but you're so important to me. I don't want to go away without understanding you. I brought the two men up front. I made one of them a proponent of the Supreme Court decision to legalize gay marriage. I had the other one be an opponent of it. They sat at the table, and the only thing they were allowed to do was to flip over the card in front of them and read it. You're stupid. I want to hear you more. That's the dumbest thing anybody could ever think. How could a Christian even come across with such a foolish thing? I can't imagine going away from this conversation not knowing more of what you think. It was living right in front of us, that we had said many of those words to each other and to the people with whom we were. So what about white Americans? How do we help this process move forward? What can we do? One of the most important conversations is the conversation around white privilege. When white privilege is discussed, most whites do not appreciate it. We mostly bristle at the supposed insinuation. But it's necessary for any and all churches that intend to share their lives and worship across cultures and colors to have a productive discussion about privilege. There are majority cultures in nearly every nation of the world. This means that from country to country, the privileged culture may be wrapped in a different color skin or speak a different language. But privilege is at the core of what the gospel seeks to remove. And it must be explored. So first, privilege, we had to learn at our church, does not have to do with assets or resources, but rather it has to do with access. In the United States of America, the demographic that enjoys the highest level of unrestricted access is that of white European. Let me offer some examples that have helped our church. Homer Plessy, New Orleans, Louisiana. Homer Plessy was born during the Civil War and became famous as an adult in the United States Supreme Court decision case known as Plessy versus Ferguson. Although Homer received a brief taste of integration in post-war South, it was short-lived. He had a fair complexion. He was 1/8 black, which categorized him as a Negro. Homer, because of his complexion, could have freely boarded any train car in his day, even those designated whites only. But he believed this to be unjust. In 1892, he purchased a first-class ticket and sat in the whites-only section. He was arrested as part of the plan to bring the segregationist laws before the court. Judge John Howard Ferguson, however, denied his rights and set the case on a track that ended up in the Supreme Court decision handed down in 1896 that we came to be known as separate but equal. Sadly, this would stay enacted for 60 more years until it would be struck down. Number two, Robert Elijah Jones, Mississippi. Jones was the first African-American general superintendent of the AME Church. While speaking for a retreat for white Christians in Ohio, Jones came up with the idea of establishing a retreat center that blacks could attend. But blacks were barred from the beaches of the Gulf of Mexico. Blacks were not allowed to go to a public beach on the Gulf of Mexico. In 1923, they had the opportunity to buy a site in Waveland, Mississippi. but they would not sell it to a black person, but they sold it to Jones because he had a light complexion. They thought they were selling it to a white man. He established the Gulf Side Assembly that allowed blacks to come to the beach for decades. Walter White, president of the NAACP, 1931 to 1955, his story is fascinating. He was a dynamic leader, and in his book, White looked white, according to himself. Of his 32 great-grandparents, 5 were black, 27 were white. But he was legally black in the United States. While he was in Arkansas investigating the lynching of blacks, he overheard a group of people suggesting that they were going to find that guy and lynch him. He was right there with them, and they didn't know it. How did this happen? Well, whites were scared of what was happening in the United States, and they wanted to codify the Racial Integrity Act of 1924, which had codified the one-drop rule. If you've got one drop of black blood in you, that's too black for us. We created our own problem by being un-Christ-like. The one-drop of blood rule sought to legally bind all U.S. Americans either to white or colored categories at birth. This one drop, 5 great-grandparents, great-great-great-grandparents out of 32, but he was black, but he looked white. George McLaurin, University of Oklahoma. 1948, he applied to the law school. He already had his undergrad and his graduate degree, but because he was black, he couldn't go to school there. They finally let him in, but he had to sit off to the side in another room. Linda Brown, Topeka, Kansas, her father, part of a class action lawsuit to have shared education, that little girls wrapped in brown skin could go to little school with little girls wrapped in lighter skin. That struck down separate but equal in the famous case of Brown versus the Board of Education. Ruby Bridges, born the same year, grew up, you'll meet her tonight, 1960. She went to the William France Elementary School on her own, protected by federal law agents, because people, including Christians, didn't believe that shared education should be accessible to her. Should U.S. military be allowed to go to college? James Meredith thought so. A 9-year veteran of the U.S. military, 2 years in Jackson State College. He applied to the University of Mississippi 3 times and was turned down. He said, "My president, commander-in-chief, said I could go to school and I was going to hold him to his word. I'm not at war with white people, I'm at war with white supremacy, a battle that many whites could join me in." I highlight these examples. They represent millions of experiences where it has nothing to do with your resources, how much you've suffered, how hard you worked, or your hard scrabble life. Bill O'Reilly. I do not know Bill O'Reilly, so I cast no dispersion on him as a person. I've never met him. I don't know him. He, in August of 2014, said that white privilege was a construct of the liberals on the left. He gave us his example, a powerful personal statement. He grew up in Levittown, New York, and had a hard scrabble life. So I was interested. So I researched Levittown, New York. Father Abraham Levitt was a builder, a Jewish man. His son William came home from the Second World War, said, "Dad, we can make a lot of money if we build subdivisions in a fresh way." Patterned houses, 6 of them. They started the modern American suburbia movement. Father Abraham Levitt is called the father of American suburbia. Our own Smithsonian Institution is going to have a Levittown exhibit of the American dream of owning a home. The only thing was, you could only own a home in Levittown if you were white. Blacks were not allowed to buy a house or rent a house. The Supreme Court struck that down 2 years later, but they already had community covenants in place. Keep the blacks out. And they were successful. In 2015, the white population of Levittown, New York is 94%. They've had the opportunity to pass down 3 generations of economic equity because blacks were not allowed, including soldiers. We have to learn to talk about things that other people have been facing that make us uncomfortable. The three words I would leave you with that have helped us the most, where our church is now 50% wrapped in my color skin, 40% wrapped in darker color skin, and the lighter brown ones make up 10%. The three words we've had to learn to say to each other with great empathy is, tell me more.
Come back down front. I'm going to open it up for just, and Jason, if you would stand as well.
Okay.
You may address any question to both or to one. So feel free in doing that at this time. We have approximately 9 minutes for questions.
Yeah. How do you help people realize that what you quoted, a lot of those statistics we consider often history, and I don't think they're historical, I think they're current. The access is currently not the same.
Correct.
How do we bring about an awareness of that? A common awareness.
What do you think? I need a minute to think. You want to respond to that first?
Don has been a part of a group that's been doing racial unity leadership summits across the country, Jerry Taylor's project. And they came to Fresno. They were very gracious to come to Fresno and do that there. And I had a hard time getting some people to come. They believed this was an Obama liberal agenda being shoved down their throats. And so just to get people to come to the table is challenging. And if I had one woman the next morning who didn't come, 68-year-old woman, widow, not here in this group, but who said to me, how'd that thing go yesterday? I said, it was good. She said, I didn't want to go. I said, why? She said, I just don't understand why people can't just get over it.
I think stories matter. You know, I do. I think stories matter. I think, tell me more. Well, one of the things we did at home that I think you guys would enjoy doing, I really do. This was just an absolute blast. I don't even know who came up with it, but whoever they are, they were brilliant. We came up with this hospitality challenge, and I shared this with their church. We did this thing, and I'd like you to try this. We said to the church, we did this 2 years ago the first time, or maybe three, that in the month of March, every member have a meal in the home of another member. No restaurants allowed. Can you imagine? And, oh, man, we got horrible pushback on this. You wouldn't believe it, you know. I don't have time. And I said, you know, you're telling me in a month you can't squeeze in an hour for a brother and sister in Christ? Man, you're sick, you know. And people are like, I can clean my house. You know, you can't shovel a path from the door to your table in a month? You know, come on, you know. And then people, it kind of got down to, you know, covetousness, jealousy, envy. So we just addressed that. I said, man, if we're going to let covetousness, envy, and jealousy drive our church, we're doomed anyway, right? So we got into it. It got off to a little slow start. It ended just with an absolute freight train racing through town. It was crazy. And we had members that didn't speak the same language. One of our elders is learning English, you know, but he's an elder for the whole church. So that's a good lesson for the church, because all of our Hispanic members have to listen live to a translation. So now all of you English-speaking members, you get to listen, you know, it's your turn. So getting the people together for hospitality was wonderful, changed conversation a lot. We changed one of our Bible classes, our largest Bible class, to where when you come in, there are 40-some tables of 5 people each. You know, those little narrow tables, they're even narrower than this. They're about half the width of this. 5 chairs around them, so you got to sit and talk, which is pretty cool, because the class is 50-50 black and white. So when you ask a question, you're staring right across at a person who potentially could have a pretty different experience. And I share stories. Like, one of our sons is African-American, and the first time we got a taste of this, 3 of our boys were together. They got pulled over for a little license plate light out, and our son Jerome is the only one that ended up in the patrol car. He wasn't even driving. And I was like, well, how did that happen? You know, he was in the back seat, but they didn't want to believe that he was like a brother or a family member. He's suspicious. That was horrible. But that happened 2 more times, where no citations, no nothing, just, you don't belong in this part of town, boy. And when that kind of stuff, as a white person, we're not used to representing our race. As white people, we hate it. Somebody says, well, white people are like this. I'm not, you know. But it would be better for us to quit doing that and say something like, tell me more about that. Tell me more about that. Well, white people don't like this, or white people are like this. Tell me more about that. Because it is inherent in our culture that many Asians, Latinos, blacks, have to deal with this every single day of their life, that they're answering for some huge group, and whites are not used to that. So we need to work with Tell Me More.
Do you think part of the problem, too, is our own unwillingness to accept our own biases? Do you think that's part of the problem?
Yes, I do. Mm-hmm. I do. Yep, I do. I really do. I think you just said so much, I wish you'd write a paper about it. Because it is... For us to, like, for instance, one day my wife and I come to the house, and our son was watching BET, and Susan didn't like the programming, so she's going to change the channel. I said, whoa, 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 he has to watch white television all the time. You do realize there's white television, right? He's got to watch white television all the time. If he's going to be a part of this family, you feel what we're working on there. And we have biases.
And to bring it around textually, what Paul's doing in that text is saying Jews don't have a right to set the agenda.
Ooh.
Gentiles are not joining the Jewish nation. Jews also need to be reconciled to God. They also have to come through the cross so that all people together are forming a new humanity. And what I think whites, we have had a hard time, and white males have had a hard time doing is saying it's not about now letting other people to the table. It's about all of us coming to a new table. And that mindset, I think, is a challenging one to wrap your head around.
Something Jason just said is giant. The word let or allow. Mm-hmm. Because white men, I am one, right? So I feel some of what we feel. I'm not saying every white guy in here feels this way. I'm saying that in general, white guys have something that they might not know they have. And that is, we have in this nation, a I can let you in mentality. I can allow you to do something mentality. And that is a very dangerous thing to let gain steam. Because we, in the beginning, we'd even hear people say, so how many do we have to let in? it's a tough journey. It's a great place.
A couple of questions back through there.
The presumption that you're operating on when you talk that way about letting them in is that it's my table.
That's right.
Well, it is my church, isn't it? I mean, I've been here 50 years.
Right, and I think that's something we don't recognize either.
Thank you.
Because we're playing with ownership. And white males own the church.
Right. That's, and see, are you hearing this wonderful reality that we're talking about today, Diesta?
Well, and to speak to that, I think also in terms, we don't even have to change our color to deal with this, because we say the same thing in regard to women.
Absolutely.
We say we're going to allow women to serve communion in our church now. I'll give you a story. I was speaking at a church in Idaho doing a women's luncheon kind of a thing, and a church in a neighboring town had written a letter to the elders, and they shared that letter with me, which was... You know, a kind of
heartbreaking.
Yeah,
it's amazing, isn't it?
A rude awakening.
Sure, the ministry.
But the letter said, "We, since Diesta Love is teaching at this church, we are not going to allow our women to attend."
That's right.
And
we own
so
them.
So much of the same kinds of things. There's male privilege. Yeah. In our church.
There's age privilege as well. There's socioeconomic privilege.
Yeah. We've got to bring it to a close. Thank you all very much. Isn't that wonderful? Now, you can read their articles in the last issue of 11 this year. So it'll be the fourth issue of 2016. That issue will go to a point where you can Google it in early 2017. So this material will be made available. That Google option, we've had over 300,000 full text downloads of 11 articles. since it began about 4 years ago. So it's a wonderful service. Bob Randolph is going to be presenting on Friday. Leonard Allen will be presenting tomorrow. And is Lauren here? She will be with us on Friday as well to join Bob Randolph. Thank you all for
Hold up. I'm not going to get a chance to do this if I don't do it right now. We are so blessed to have the pioneers of Stuart and the Yes to Love. When our family first came to Churches of Christ, I was 13 years old. These guys were leading and making a difference in my hometown of Portland, Oregon. And I know I wouldn't get a chance to do this otherwise, but I love these folks and I love the families that they've raised. And
we had a hand in polluting you, didn't we?
Let's show them our appreciation.